This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin a week-long series featuring a few of our favorite music interviews from our archive. Jay-Z, Lizzo, Roseanne Cash, Smokey Robinson, and Pete Seeger are just some of the people in the series. To start it off, we have the interview I recorded with Keith Richards, a founding member of the Rolling Stones who is still the band's guitarist. He co-wrote much of the Stones' classic repertoire with Mick Jagger, including Satisfaction, Let's Spend the Night Together, Get Off My Cloud, Gimme Shelter, Sympathy for the Devil, and Beast of Burden. A four-part BBC series about the Stones, with each episode focused on a different member of the band, has been showing this month on Epix and is also streaming. I spoke with Keith Richards in 2010, after his autobiography, Life, was published. Keith Richards, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. Now, I remember when the Stones started to record that in America we were expected to pick a team. Who do you like best, the Stones or the Beatles?
And the competition thing, yeah.
Yeah, and you write about, you know, when the Stones started getting going, that you didn't want to copy the Beatles, and you decided to be the anti-Beatles. So what did that mean in terms of your music and your image?
You know, I think, yeah, if you're talking image-wise, we probably did make a sort of decision to not be the Fab Four, I think. Also, there were different, differences between the bands. The Beatles were basically a vocal band, you know. They all sang, and one song, John would take the lead, another Paul, another George, and sometimes Ringo, right? But our band set up totally differently, with one front man, one lead singer, right? And what I loved about it was that there's an incredible difference in that way between the Beatles and ourselves. But at the same time, we were there at the same time, and you're dealing with each other, you know? And it was a very, very fruitful and great relationship between the Stones and the Beatles. It was very, very friendly. The competition thing didn't come into it as far as we were concerned.
You have a great story in your book about how you co-wrote, well, how you got Satisfaction started. You co-wrote the song with Mick Jagger, but you originated it and you didn't know you were doing it. Can you?
I wish all the songs could come this way, you know, whether you just dream of them. And then the next morning, there they are, presented to you. But Satisfaction was that sort of miracle that took place. I had one of the first little cassette players, you know, Norelco, whatever, Philips, the same thing, really. But it was a fascinating little machine to me, a cassette player, that you could actually just lay ideas down, and, you know, wherever you were. I set the machine up and I put in a fresh tape. I go to bed as usual with my guitar, and I wake up the next morning. I see that the tape has run to the very end, and I think, well, I didn't do anything. You know? I said, maybe I hit a button while I was asleep, you know. So I put it back to the beginning and push play. And there, in some sort of ghostly version, is I can't get no satisfaction. And so there's a whole verse of it. I won't bore you with it all. And after that, there's, I don't know, 40 minutes of me snoring. But there's the song and its embryo, and I actually dreamt the damn thing, you know what I mean? And I'm still waiting for another dream.
Now, how did the line, I can't get no satisfaction, come to you at a time when you should have been having a lot of very satisfying, gratifying moments?
Darling, I don't know. I dreamt it.
No, true. Okay.
I mean, nobody's ever satisfied, right? And it was just a phrase that obviously, you know, was buzzing through the mind. And whether you could express anything or enlarge on that idea of, because otherwise I can't get any satisfaction. It's kind of, you know, sort of moaning. But then you can take it and expand it, and which Mick did brilliantly. There it is. I mean, these things are all made out of just little sparks of ideas that come to you, and you're lucky to be around to grab them. And that's kind of basically the process of how we work.
Okay, so let's hear Satisfaction. This is the Rolling Stones. My guest is Keith Richards, and he's written a new autobiography called Life. That's the Rolling Stones, and my guest is Keith Richards, and he's written his autobiography. It's called Life. Now, that cassette that you mentioned that you used to write down the idea for Satisfaction in the middle of the night, that so surprised you when you played it back in the morning, that cassette, or one just like it, was also really helpful to you in coming up with a kind of transformative guitar sound. Would you describe how you would plug your acoustic guitar in motel rooms into
it's a good question. I'll try, because there I am. I now have my hands on the best amplifiers in the world and the best guitars, but I'm trying to translate another sound in my head that I can't find through conventional means. I was at the time, I always play a lot of acoustic guitar. And the cassette machine gave me, in those days, before they had things on them called governors, which means that you could not overload the machinery, I would just shove the acoustic guitar and use, basically, I would use the cassette player as an amplifier, basically. And overload the acoustic guitar so it becomes an electric guitar. But at the same time, you see, you still have that feel of an acoustic, which is totally different to an electric. So I'm still looking for the perfect example of this, but I'm going to keep going.
So what you would get is like an electrified acoustic guitar that was also distorted.
Exactly. You got it, Terry. You got it. That's it. I was trying to get the quality and the touch that you can get from an acoustic guitar and then overload it and make it sound like an electric guitar. But at the same time, you have that original acoustic touch, because, you know, this gets complicated because guitars are strange animals. There's a touch that you can get off an acoustic guitar that you'll never get off an electric. And so I was trying to figure how to electrify the acoustic feel and still translate it. And so that was the name of the game. That was it.
Now, it was surprising enough to me to read how you did this in your motel room, but then reading how you did it also in the recording studio was fascinating, that you wanted that sound so much that you brought in the cassette machine and plugged your acoustic guitar into it.
Yes, I mean, I took these ideas, and we, the Stones were in the studio, and we were all looking at it, and then it doesn't have what you had on the, on the original idea, and so finally, after many attempts to try and reproduce this sort of idea, with amplifiers and, conventionally. I think it was Charlie Watts, maybe. Let's go back to how you did it in the first place. and work it from there, you know, which is why you got Street Fighting Man and Jumping Jack Flashes. There are no electric guitars at all. It's just overloaded acoustics. I don't know, I like that denseness of color, of feel, that you can get out of that. And it's an experiment I might take up again once they start making cassette machines again.
So, do you think Jumpin' Jack Flash is a good illustration of what you're doing?
Yeah, and Street Fighting Man is probably another great example of it.
Which one would you rather hear?
I love them both, honey. Don't ask me to cut the babies in half.
All right, so we'll go with Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Go there. All right, yeah.
So here's the Rolling Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and my guest Keith Richards playing the kind of plugged into the cassette machine guitar that he was just describing. And he has an autobiography called Life. Then there are the songs that you describe as anti-girl songs that the Stones did, like Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, Yesterday's Papers. And this is where I've been so ambivalent about some of the Stones songs, like Under My Thumb. Under My Thumb is so catchy. I mean, I think it's just like irresistible what's going on, like melodically and rhythmically in there. And then, you know, I catch myself singing along, and what am I singing, you know, like about this girl who's like,
you know,
under his thumb. And so were you ever ambivalent about that?
Let me try and break in here. Go ahead. Terry, break in here. Yep. And say you can take it as male, female, or it's just people. I mean, it could be about a guy, it could have been, you know, this is just a guy thing, you know, that probably you're actually under her thumb and you're just trying to fight back, you know. And these are all the relationships and stuff. And I wouldn't take it as any, like, sexism. I can't even go there, you know, but I don't think about it. I just think, you know, we know what some people are like, and those things happen. Anyway, I didn't write the lyrics.
Cut to the chase. Off the hook. Ask you about your relationship with Mick Jagger. You grew up in the same neighborhood. You've known him since you were a boy. You were obviously very close for a long period of time, co-wrote so many songs together. But at the same time, you write about
hey, there's how problems down the road. Yeah,
yeah, about how, right, in the beginning of the
80s. Let me preempt you.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I mean, you think in a 50-year relationship doing this stuff, that there's not going to be some conflict, some disagreements. Of course there's going to be.
But you describe him as having become unbearable in the early 80s.
At times, yes.
What made him unbearable in those times?
An attitude, it's all in the book. And I don't want to expand on it with you, Terry. What I've said is in the book. I can't say anything more than that.
But let me quote something that you say in the book, and this was, you write how, in the early 80s, this is right after you had kicked heroin, and you said, "Mick seemed to like one side of me being a junkie, the one that kept me from interfering in day-to-day business." And you say that after you kicked, you wanted a more active say in what the band did, but apparently Mick Jagger didn't really want you to have one? Do I read that right?
Yeah. He got used to holding the reins and... And that was a bit of a shock to me at the time, but I got to live with it. And anyway, what happened is that we ended up sharing the reins again. But at the time, yeah, that did shock me. Or disappointed me, to say. I mean, shock, I'm beyond, But, and I'd leave it at that, quite honestly. It was a bit of a surprise to me at the time. But it gave me more of an insight into Mick himself. I said, "Hey, man, all right, go for it." I mean, it's only rock and roll, honey.
So just one more question about this, which is when you were performing on stage together during this period of great friction, do you feel it on stage? Did you try to prevent the audience from feeling that friction?
Here. This is a bunch of guys that have been together for yonks, I mean, you don't carry stuff like this onto stage. These are things that just happen and you deal with them and you get it over with, forget about it. This is not some angst or a big deal, Of course, guys have fights, brothers have fights all the time. That's what it's all about. It's, to pick one thing out and say, it's a festering wound, what rubbish. No, we're brothers. We get along and we fight sometimes. And I don't think I can express it any better than that.
So I'm going to play Beast of Burden. Do you want to say anything about writing it or what you're playing on it?
No, I loved it. It's another one that came very natural, sitting around with Mick. Here's one. Mick, see, I write songs for Mick to sing. That's what I do. I mean, you don't get Midnight Ramblers out of nowhere. You don't get Gimme Shelters out of nowhere. I'm writing because I say, man, I know this guy can handle this and nobody will ever be able to handle it any other way. What I do is write songs for Mick to sing. And if he picks up on it, baby, we got. If he doesn't, I just let it sit on the shelf.
What are the qualities in his voice and in his personality that you feel you're writing for?
He's an outstanding performer. Hey, you're talking about a mixture of James Brown and Maria Callas here. I gotcha.
That's good.
And to have to work with such an outsized personality, ego, and say, hey, whatever it takes, it's there. And you gotta go for it. And sometimes it doesn't work, and a lot of times it does. And so you just keep on pushing,
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. And all best to you. Thank you very much.
Hey, Terry. Thanks very much. Good try, honey.
My interview with Keith Richards was recorded in 2010, after the publication of his autobiography, Life. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll listen back to my interview with another great rock guitarist, Brian May, a founding member of the band Queen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.